Hi, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable. How are you all? It's Monday. It's Easter Monday, and it's the 21st of April for those of you who celebrate. Happy Easter Monday for those of you who celebrate. Happy Patriots Day for those of you who celebrate. Happy Monday. I hope you had a beautiful weekend and celebrated it in fine style and had a very nice time, perhaps with family and loved ones, and otherwise just enjoyed the days that we were given. We have a lot to talk about this morning. Obviously, key is the passing of Pope Francis at the age of 88, which comes to us this news just early this morning released, and obviously the Pope did appear at the Easter Mass yesterday and then died a short time later. So we will talk more about that in a moment, as obviously we have a lot of other stories to talk about as well. But boy, do we have a great panel to do it with. So let me introduce them to you this morning. And also, just a reminder, you can always be a part of this program, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. All right, let us begin with Jim Ketterer. Jim is Senior Fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. Thanks for having me. Good to be back.
Good to have you here, as always. We welcome political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post. How is Libby this morning?
Oh, Libby's fine.
Good.
Libby's okay.
Okay. Know. All right.
Libby can eat bread now. His Passover's over.
You should spend the whole show talking about yourself in the third person.
Yes. Really. Well, somebody else does that, don't they? Yeah.
Yes.
Somebody.
All right. We also welcome, we're thrilled to have the mayor of the city of Albany with us, Kathy Sheehan. Good morning, Mayor. How are you?
I am wonderful. I had a wonderful Easter weekend with family and got to work in my garden a little bit. So it was a beautiful weekend.
We had amazing Easter dinner, but I don't think I tasted any of it.
Yeah, you still sound a little under the weather, so.
A little nasal.
Yeah.
And Mark Whitman is with us, investment banker on Wall Street. Good morning, Mark. How are you?
I'm good, Joe. It was a nice weekend. I dug around in the dirt on Saturday, and then for Easter, we went down to Brooklyn and saw some family, so it was very pleasant.
Very nice. My thanks to all of you for being here this morning. And we welcome you again into the conversation, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. So the big story is the fact that Pope Francis has died at the age of 88. His groundbreaking pontificate worked to make the Catholic Church more inclusive. Cardinals will now decide to continue his approach or restore more conservative leadership, perhaps, and we will see over the time. The Vatican announced the passing on Monday, ending a groundbreaking pontificate that sought, however haltingly, to reshape the Roman Catholic Church into a more inclusive institution. Standing somberly behind a microphone at the Vatican, Cardinal Kevin Farrell announced the Pope's death. At 7:35 this morning, the Bishop of Rome, Francis, returned to the House of the Father. He said, an American of Irish origin, Cardinal Farrell becomes the Vatican's de facto administrator after the death of a Pope. And I know this may not be appropriate, but I did think this morning that I have to watch Conclave again just to remember how this whole process goes through. And so this was a pope who was elected about a dozen years ago and has done great things within the church, has stirred things up within the church. You will also remember that just a month ago, he was in for a very long stay in the hospital for pneumonia. And it was amazing to many that he was able to leave the hospital and then was out for several days before his passing. And in keeping with a pontiff who made unpredictability and a resistance to expectations a hallmark of his papacy. He did speak at the Easter service in yesterday, and there have been a couple of things that I wanted to mention. One is that the last person, the last meeting, I believe, was with J.D. Vance, which happened on... the jokes are too easy. Just don't do them.
Who's joking? I'm just,
And so met with him on Saturday. And then Joseph Biden, the second Roman Catholic president, said in a statement that Pope Francis was unlike any who came before him. The former president called Francis a loving pastor and challenging teacher who reached out to difficult faiths and mentioned his advocacy on peace, poverty, and climate issues. Above all, he was a pope for everyone. He wrote on social media, he was the people's pope, a light of faith, hope, and love. Seems like a good place to start. Kathy Sheehan.
Well, I think that when you look at just even locally here, the challenges that the Albany Diocese has with looking at closing additional parishes and trying to understand what the future of the Catholic Church looks like, that, you know, the Pope certainly sought to, I think, expand how we think about church. I think there are those of us who had hoped that the church under his leadership, and he certainly opened the conversation and should be given credit for that and didn't shut it down, but around who can be ordained, married priests, women as priests, women in leadership positions. You know, I think those are all things that people had hoped under his papacy we would get actual changes around, but certainly should be credited for not shutting down the debate, which often happened under more conservative popes. And so, you know, he leaves behind a church that I think there's still a lot of questions about its future, its direction, you know, its relevance. I think that one of the areas where I think we should really pay attention is the work that he did around the marginalized, around immigrants, mm-hmm. around, you know, looking at him traveling to Sudan to try to bring peace. And as the United States shuts down U.S. aid and pulls back on the aid that we are providing and we're providing in some of these distant areas, that the Pope certainly understood the importance of engaging and being present in those places. And so at a time that the United States is pulling out, I think that those who are faithful should be mindful of the full message of this Pope and really question what we should be doing in these places that he so, you know, openly and you know, the places that he traveled to and the marginalized that he was seeking to have us look at and see and not ignore, I think, is an important legacy.
He believed the church should listen to the people within the pews, he said, and one of his legacies, many at the Vatican say, will be his openness to dialogue. As you said, this includes immigrants, issues of the environment, politics, gender, LGBTQ plus issues. And while in some cases not great strides made, there were conversations and there was some movement within those quarters during his 12 years. Libby.
Well, you know, he was clear that Catholic priests couldn't officiate at official weddings, LGBT weddings, you know, same-sex weddings, but he did say that priests could bless the unions. And so for those in the LGBT community whose faith is important to them, and if they were Catholic and part of Dignity, which is the group of LGBT Catholics that was started decades ago, you know, this is an important thing. He was more forward-thinking than any of the popes in my lifetime, He came out of the liberation theology of South America, which, you know, was a whole different way of looking at Catholicism and getting back to the basic teachings of Christ, which is to care for the poor and give people the hand up that they need and just being compassionate, which is not something we're seeing too often today out of some Christian quarters. So, you know, was he 100%? No, but he was better than any of the other ones. I mean, I remember Pope Benedict, and he was a nightmare when it came to the LGBT community, even with his red shoes. So I'm like, you know, I'll take Francis over some of the other guys.
Benedict, who left the post.
Yeah, because he was sick. It had been hundreds of years between the last time a pope stepped down because of health and him.
Yes.
Like 400 or 500 years.
And right, then, which brought us
and
to,
then gave us Francis.
That's right. Mark Whitman.
Joe, I think a lot of the misunderstanding of this pope comes out of a certain couple factors. I think number one, we always talk about, well, often it's talked about the declining enrollment and participation in the church. And I think some people get confused. They think that the Catholic Church is a group meant to promote membership. It's not. It's a group meant to promote a religious mission that a certain group of individuals has decided is the mission handed down to them from Christ. And so I think once you separate that mission from the popularity of the church, you come a lot further in your thinking about what the church is up to. That's a different question than saying what it should be up to. I also think that Pope Francis saw the evangelical outreach mission of the church very, very broadly. He acknowledged the sin inherent in mankind, as the church believes. There are also many who believe that he still felt somewhat responsible for his role, or at least lack of action, pushing against the dirty war in Argentina when he was mm-hmm. a bishop there, and that he was trying to make amends for that and realize the frailty of humanity and the importance of the church in helping. But he was doctrinarily very strict. He did not change any of the key tenets of the church that some had hoped for. And I think that contrast between what he thought the role of outreach was versus what he thought the central set of beliefs should be was something that the press and onlookers got confused, and they sort of saw that they wondered if he was prescribing a different mission for the church because of that, but I don't think he really was if you look at what he did in a compartmentalized fashion. And I will say he was a man who I think wanted to move the church more than it did move. Libby mentioned the blessing of same-sex marriages. Mm-hmm. And it was reported that very quickly in the wake of that, the titularly lead cardinal in Africa went to the Vatican and berated the Pope and got an exception for Africa because homosexuality is so dimly viewed still in Africa traditionally. And I think that underscores not only the issues that this pope faced, but I also think it's a bit of a harbinger in terms of, as we think about what the next papacy will look like, that there are still very vibrant and even growing in some ways conservative forces mm-hmm. within the Catholic Church. So what we see next may not be a continual liberalization even of the evangelical mission of the church.
I just want to make one point, and the African clergy, not just the Catholic, but the Episcopal clergy also in Africa, is one of the reasons why the Episcopal Church has split,
right?
Because you had people in this country like Bishop Love, who was here, and a lot of the more conservative African clergy who couldn't abide by the Episcopal Church of embracing the LGBT community, embracing same-sex marriage. And so there was that split. So it's not just the Catholics, it's others as well.
Jim Ketter.
Yeah, I think so Pope Francis was the first ever Jesuit pope, and the Society of Jesus has existed since the middle 1500s. and yet there had never been a Jesuit pope. And it's an order within the Catholic Church that's really focused on education, has created many institutions of education and higher education, including across this country, hospitals, outreach to different religious institutions and different cultures. And we saw all of that definitely manifested in the time of Pope Francis's rule. And, you know, he really lived it. In terms of his time in Argentina, I mean, he's the son of immigrants who came from Italy. So I think he comes to the question of immigration with a firsthand experience. And he also, you know, he really did. He was a Jesuit during the time that Mark was talking about, the Dirty War, during the time of liberation theology. But he tried to strike a balance and I think ended up aggravating all sides in doing so. But, you know, I think you could also see a lot of that when he was Pope, you know, trying to be diplomatic, trying to push things but not push them too much. As they say in government, I think it's also true in the church, personnel is policy. He changed a lot of the personnel over his 12 years. Half of the College of Cardinals were appointed by him. Many of the bishops around the world appointed and approved by him. And he was pretty active in removing bishops over the sexual abuse scandals, over financial improprieties, and in some cases over questions of doctrine. He was active in removing people and putting in others that he wanted to see. So I think, you know, the question of what is going to happen, not only in choosing a new pope, but with the nature of the church going forward, a lot of that is going to be the legacy of that personnel.
We'll take a break. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We've been talking about the death of Pope Francis, who died at the age of 88. It was announced by the Vatican early this morning. An inclusive style that won him adoration and criticism, even as he made relatively few changes to Catholic doctrine. We've heard from most of our panelists. I did have to cut Jim off so we could get to a break, so we go back to him.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. I just wanted to also add on some thoughts about the state of play with the American Catholic Church, and that you see real challenges, as Kathy was talking about, whether people are going to attend religious services, whether they're really going to be active members of the church. But you also see a very serious split on questions of religious doctrine, but also a serious political split. And you have seen over the past few presidential elections a fairly even split. Obama won the Catholic vote 2 times, and Trump won it by 4 points. In 2016, I think it was about a tie in 2020, when you had a Catholic president, who Joe Biden, was running. And then in 2024, Trump won it by 18 points. And so how this all plays out at the same time that there's going to be a selection of a new pope, and as I said before, as we have, you know, a lot of Francis's people now in place as bishops and as cardinals, I think we're going to continue to see real roiling in the U.S. Catholic Church.
Well, and I think, though, you have to question what is that political strength, because I think when you see that 18-point spread, you have to factor in that time period, the number of people who no longer are practicing Catholics. And so as the church catered to far more conservative, we are not changing, this is the way things are, the response to and the very slow response to the sex abuse scandal, the continued movement to, you know, the conservative indoctrination. You know, I watched as I would go to Catholic services, and I felt like it was more and more you know, back to the old, you know, the incensor and all of these very ritualistic, the stressing the importance of ritual, right? And so, you know, by definition, those who still would identify as Catholic, doesn't surprise me that would be the result. I think what you have to factor in is what happened to all those other folks, and yeah. That is what's happening within the church.
Yeah, a lot of the kind of post-Vatican II social justice Catholics were the ones, I think, who were most likely to leave the church. Right. And so that left in a lot of the more kind of doctrinaire Baltimore Catechism Catholics. That's true. But you also see interesting splits and shifts among different constituencies within the American Catholic Church. So you saw Obama win a huge percentage of the Hispanic Catholics.
Correct.
And you saw it start to shift in 2016, mm-hmm. and you saw a major shift in 2024 toward Trump. You also see differences between men and women. Men consistently in the three elections for Trump voting for Trump, and women voting for the Democrat candidate more often. And so, you know, it's not a monolithic group of people, and it's not a static group of people. But you're quite right, Kathy, that, you know, the constituency that self-selected out of the church, I think, was one that was most likely to not vote for Trump.
And I think for people to think about what the bishop here said, which is he's looking at potentially closing a third of the parishes in this diocese. This is after major downsizings that occurred in the 90s. And it speaks to, I think, the challenge of the church going forward and how much of a political force it is.
Well, and brought on because of the bankruptcies and great difficulty to get people to come to church.
And to find priests.
And to find priests, exactly. Yeah. And but to your point, I mean, the idea of, and I'm looking at Jim, but the point of those who left, of I never felt that there was an adequate, and maybe even there really was very little outreach to those to come back and to foster a conversation to allow them and to bring them back into the church with some solace as to, because a lot of us, and I would include myself in this group, had a lot of questions and great concerns.
Right. And if the message that you were getting and others were getting was that, you know, questions are not allowed, dialogue is not allowed, and you have to adhere to a strict doctrine, that's very different than saying, in the way that I think Francis was trying to say, let's cast a wide net and be as inclusive as possible, but still stand for something. And that means you have to have an ongoing debate and dialogue and an understanding of differences of opinion. Those are two very different views of the institution of the Catholic Church.
And you would go, many would then go pre-shopping, where you would go and you would try to find yeah. someone who had a more liberal or conservative view that you felt comfortable with, which I never remember growing up as a Catholic.
Oh, we priest-shopped when I was a kid.
Yeah, but was it because
Oh, yeah.
Was it, you know, personality,
I will say, my father was a lifelong Republican. My mother was a lifelong Democrat. But my father had very progressive views about where he thought the Catholic Church, the direction that it should be going in.
Right.
And so when we moved to this little town in Ohio, the priest at the parish that was in our town was as conservative could be. And so we started driving to Kent State University, which was about 20, 25 minutes away, and attending the church on campus at Kent State. And so, yeah, I mean, and that was absolutely about a more inclusive church. It was about letting women speak. It was about being able to have good and productive conversations and debates about our faith and what it meant. And so that's what I was exposed to when I was younger. And so I guess it's no surprise that I'm here today.
You see the split going
I guess I'm revealing too much.
Shocking.
No, not at all.
Absolutely shocking.
Yeah. You see it going in the other direction, too, though. I mean, you saw, you know, groups of people who really never got over the reforms of Vatican II in the 1960s
and
wanting the Mass still to be in Latin, and some churches even in this area that reinstituted the Latin Mass and things
still
like that.
On.
So, so those splits are there and they're real. And they're not just on politics, but the politics is the way I think they most often get noticed. And, you know, the political sway, as Kathy was saying, that the church has had over time in New York politics, I think also you see this roiling that really doesn't make it so easy to kind of size it up. Well, this is the stance of the church versus this.
I'm struck by what Kathy said about church shopping, because now when I think about it, my father's uncle, so my great uncle, was bishop of the Archdiocese of New York City, Stephen J. Donahue, and he was, larger than life, and you would go and I know maybe about 60% of the things, 70% of the things that he preached, my father rolled his eyes at, and you know, so I think a lot of it was in response to that to try to get away. Which is interesting because we found it not so much in New York, but we lived in Philadelphia at that time and found a parish that was a little more inclusive. But it is interesting, and I think Catholics are still trying to do that. But of course, with so few churches and so few priests, one priest taking over seven churches on a Sunday or Saturday and Sunday is insane, absolutely insane.
Well, and you see, you know, a lot of the kind of leading Jesuit universities that are no longer having Jesuits as presidents because there just aren't that many Jesuits to pick from. And some see this as a great step forward, and others see it as a real loss. Again, it kind of breaks down along those political lines.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll move on to other topics. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Claire writes to us and says, why did I leave the church after 50 years? Just look at the Supreme Court, many of whom are Catholics, or J.D. Vance, Marco Rubio, and that Tom guy, Tom Homan, who is deporting everyone. That's not the religious beliefs I hold dear. What would Jesus do? None of the stuff these guys are doing. That's from Claire. Then we go to Deborah, who notes that he's not being buried in the Vatican, Pope Francis, as most popes are, but rather in a part of Rome that is very connected to immigrants. Also, the Pope's meeting with Vance and death the next day reminds me of Queen Elizabeth meeting Liz Truss and then dying the next day.
Right.
I must say I admire the Pope's tenacity and I appreciate his supposed chastising of Vance. Perhaps the Pope knew he had one more important job to accomplish before he left us. That from Deborah. All right. I would like to move on to other stories. Another big story making news. Of course, you all remember the Signal chat scandal. Well, now there is a second Signal chat scandal. And this is a New York Times report that came out yesterday afternoon saying that the defense secretary sent sensitive information about strikes in Yemen to an encrypted group chat that included his wife, his brother, and other friends, according to people familiar with the matter. A couple things to keep in mind about this. He shared detailed information about forthcoming strikes in Yemen on March 15th in a private Signal group chat that included his wife, brother, and personal lawyer. This is according to four people with knowledge of the chat. Mr. Hegseth's wife, Jennifer, a former Fox News producer, is not a Defense Department employee, but she has traveled with him overseas and drawn criticism for accompanying her husband to sensitive meetings with foreign leaders. He shared essentially the same information and attack plans that he shared on a separate Signal chat the same day that mistakenly included the editor of The Atlantic, although this was done on a private, his private phone. The previously unreported existence of the second Signal chat in which Mr. Hegseth shared highly sensitive military information is the latest in a series of developments that have put his management and judgment under scrutiny. Okay, that is part one of the story. Then there is the fact that three senior advisors of his were fired over the weekend, apparently for leaking. We can only assume that it was this information, but we have no way of knowing that for sure yet. But it would make sense in that particular category. And then finally, you have one of his biggest backers talking to, writing in Politico yesterday, saying that the Pentagon has been in absolute turmoil and it is time for the president to take action and to remove Pete Hegseth from the position of Secretary of Defense. Jim.
Yeah, geez, what a the story that just keeps on giving. So, you know, there are various levels of classification in the U.S. government. And top secret sounds like it would be top, but it's not the top. It's sort of the middle range classified level that you get. When I worked at the National Security Council, I had a clearance that was above that level. If you're the Secretary of Defense, you are seeing things that are at that level and above, and things that are for, you know, a very small group of people to see. And military operations and those details are some of those things, and they are protected very closely for good reason. Because if you don't do that, then our adversaries that are always probing, looking, finding for a weak link can get that information and they can act on it in one way or another, or they can wait until there's another opportunity to dig into this weak link of information. And so to use your private phone, I mean, even if you were just sort of a mid-level employee at the Department of Defense or in an intelligence services or something, you would be marched out of the building, probably arrested on the spot. I mean, that is just kind of, you know, dealing with classified material 101. And I am absolutely sure that if he was doing this with his private phone on this issue, then he has been regularly using his private phone to deal with all kinds of classified, sensitive information. And this is just an absolute goldmine for our adversaries. I would also say to people who are supportive of this administration, how is it that you can justify supporting this? How can you defend this kind of behavior? Not only just the kind of, you know, childish behavior of the, you know, his inner Hegseth's inner circle and the backstabbing and the leaking and all of this, but, you know, putting troops' lives at risk, putting our kind of closest secrets at risk to being revealed. I just am astounded that people would see loyalty to a person or to a political administration above the safety of our troops and the conduct of our military operations. That's outrageous. In terms of his wife, the Wall Street Journal, no liberal rag, was already writing stories on her accompanying Hegseth to meetings, being in meetings that were classified. The very nature of the substance of what was discussed was classified. She doesn't have a clearance. She doesn't work for the U.S. government. That also is just not even remotely allowed. That's an absolutely outrageous violation of these sorts of guardrails for classified information.
And I don't know how this works, but is it common for a secretary to have so many people within his inner circle who are related to him?
Yeah, I think that's certainly unusual. I mean, in addition to his brother, we also see that his personal lawyer,
right,
is in his inner circle, because you might remember that Donald Trump fired not only the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, but also the head of the legal entities for each of the armed services, the JAGs, the Judge Adjutant Generals. And one of the people who was put in place when those people were fired was Hegseth's personal lawyer. And they brought him back into the military and made him have this important role with the JAGs. That's already concerning, even before you start dealing with this failure to follow basic guidelines on the use of classified information. I want to, definitely let my colleagues weigh in on this too, but maybe we can circle back and talk about what the substance of this was all about, which is Yemen, and the failure of the administration to really talk to the American people as to what is the plan, what's the policy, what are the goals, what are we actually doing when we're sending our troops into harm's way. We just 2 days ago carried out another deadly attack on an oil port and killed between 70 and 80 people, mostly civilians, in Yemen. To what end? What's going on?
Well, and I think, to your point about what is classified information, I mean, the fact that we're still having a debate over it and that we're allowing the lie to be told that this was not classified information, It speaks to, I've kind of pushed off those who have started to refer to those who are loyal to Trump as a cult. But when you're releasing the time, targets, and weapons hours in advance of an attack, if that's not classified information, then nothing is. He put people in harm's way. And now we find out that he didn't just do this in a signal chat among people who, other than the reporter who was accidentally added to it, who would have been allowed to know this information, but on his personal phone. I mean, let's remember, tens of thousands of people in stadiums across this country shouted, "Lock her up,"
right,
about Hillary Clinton,
right,
for having a server that was deemed to be questionable as to whether it was secure enough to hold classified information, with absolutely no allegations or proof that classified information actually got into the hands of people who weren't supposed to have it. We now have proof. I mean, we know that people who did not have the security clearances got this information on a personal cell phone. He should be arrested, to your point.
Yeah.
I don't know how you describe it as other than a cult. Like, it's okay that a bunch of, it's this, like, frat boy, and I don't want to insult fraternity brothers because my brothers were in fraternities, but it's this frat boy mentality of, we can just do whatever we want, and isn't this fun? We're like in this playground where we get access to stuff and we're going to use it to flex.
And there's no debate about what's classified on the information itself. It will always say, this is the classification level. And as Kathy said, I'm 100% sure that these military operations were classified at the very, very, very highest level. And so it's not even a question of debate. So to just say, well, it's not classified, is just an outright lie.
A lot's happened in the last 6 months,
yeah,
I've noticed. And you forget this was the guy who won by one vote, by J.D. Vance, and who ultimately put him in position. He was the one who had the most conflict and anger toward him in becoming and in being selected, including from his own mother, who told him to get some help and take an honest look at yourself. She since apologized for that. But my God, the therapy it would take for me to get over that. good Lord. But now to see this again come back as I'm what Kathy was saying is just so struck me as exactly. I mean, you do this once in this. Not that you can pass that off in that signal chat, the first signal chat, but then to use your private phone and start just basically, I mean, for want of a better term, bragging, right?
Yeah.
Like
showing off.
Look at the cool stuff I know.
Look at the stuff I know.
He's a clout chaser. I mean, it's insane.
He's 12. Yeah. You know, he's 12. But I'm glad you brought up. I mean, really, what about the emails? Because they skewered Hillary around emails. And now they're just, and this wasn't the only thing that happened this weekend. There was another incident this morning, or this weekend, where plans about the White House, like architectural and where things, where the tunnels are and all that sort of stuff, got sent out to a lot of people. A lot of people.
It was GSA,
the General Services Administration.
But it was both the Biden and the Trump administration.
Right, but still, one would think that maybe this administration would learn from the last. But I think Mark, you said something about, you know, aiding and abetting our enemies. We're you know that they that the people are looking, our enemies are looking, constantly and surveilling us. The problem is, maybe you said this, Jim. The issue is, Trump is already giving them the information, right? Trump is way too close to Putin, thinks he's a great old guy, right? Because they're both autocrats. The guy from Turkey, Orban, as well.
Erdogan.
Erdogan and Orban in Hungary. I mean, they're all of an ilk. And so he's already given away the store and the secrets.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue and hear from our other panelists on this. We welcome your letters as well. We have quite a few. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Senior fellow at Bard College for Civic Engagement, Jim Ketterer, is with us. Libby Post, political consultant and lobbyist. Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan and investment banker on Wall Street Mark Whitman make up our panel. We are currently talking about Pete Hegseth and the new jolt with more allegations regarding a Signal chat and the Signal app with the defense secretary accused of sharing pre-operational details involving a Yemen bomb strike with a group of close associates and family. This is separate from the first group chat that was reported last month. Mark Whitman.
Joe, I got to tell you, I'm surprised everybody's surprised. And maybe that's unfair. But Pete Hegseth wasn't qualified for this job when he was appointed to it. His actions are that of a knucklehead is the technical term at best. And he's still proven himself incapable, and he will continue to do so. I think it's clear Trump realized that the level of churn that he had within his first administration made accomplishing his agenda more difficult than it might otherwise have been. So he's trying to dampen that. I also think he's reluctant to give his critics, you know, a win by putting a body out on the street. And I agree with what Jim, I think, intonated. He can correct me if I'm wrong. My fears actually are around leaking the wrong things. Fortunately, they got away with these without costing lives or American lives. But, you know, U.S. military policy around the world matters. It's a life and death issue. And I think it's clear the administration is dealing in a depth that at least Pete Hegseth is incapable of when he starts to talk about that the United States, quote unquote, successfully bombed Yemen. And I won't go too far into this, Joe, unless we want to. But the UAE and the Saudi Arabians, with ordnance that in many cases we sold them, spent over $10 billion before we got there bombing the Houthis.
Almost 10 years.
Right.
Yeah.
And guess what? The Houthis are still in charge of transit through the waterways over their shores. And that's going to continue so long as we fail to come to some sort of accommodation with Tehran, frankly. It's that simple to boil it down. So I thought that this, the Yemen attack, was sort of a message to the Iranian government ahead of some of these talks. And I pray and I hope that the talks go well and that they solve this and a number of other issues. But even that, I mean, remind me, Steve Witkoff, is that how you pronounce his name? I mean, he's now Trump's emissary to everywhere, as best I understand it. And there's no way any one person is capable of dealing with Tehran, with Russia, and he's somewhere else, too. I forget the other set of negotiations. Oh, in the Middle East, too. So just the fact that these people are trying to, that they, even if he were capable, which that guy isn't, the fact that he's trying to do three things at once, I worry about the level of competency generally. I think we're going to continue to see, you know, problems result because of the lack of competency. This isn't surprising at all. I'm just holding my breath for something more serious, right? Well,
yeah, I don't think any of us disagree with you. I mean, I think it is, it's not surprising. I don't think anybody was like, oh my God, that's shocking. I didn't think he would be that dumb. Yeah, probably, but...
Yeah, I think I meant, I can't believe I live in a world where...
Right.
I'm not surprised by it, but I have to acknowledge that, believe I live in a world
that die
where
was,
we're having this conversation.
That die was cast?
Yes. Oh, yeah. No, I knew... Yeah, this is... I said it the day after the election when I was on here. Like, radical acceptance. This is what people voted for.
That's... And the fact that, you know... This is going to happen if you name this guy to this post. And then as the things start to be added to the list, you're still to the point of, well, is someone going to step in and take care of that?
Can I tell you what really scares me? Let's go back to a side comment that Donald Trump made in the Oval Office to Zelensky. He said, you're playing with World War III. Mm-hmm. Why did Donald Trump say that? Because if you think about it, there's nothing that Zelensky can do to start World War III. He would do any and everything he could to get a hold of Russia to improve the Ukrainians' military presence. Trump said that because his advisors told them there are reasons why the Biden administration didn't go after Russia or put United States boots on the ground, because that really is a situation that risks World War III. And Trump, as he does so many times, projected that fear on to Zelensky. So if you want to talk about what I worry about at night, this clown Pete Hegseth and his android, I don't worry about. I worry about the more serious issues that face this world currently.
But go ahead.
The thing is, we have an imposter in chief who refuses to admit he's wrong. And so if you refuse to admit that you're wrong about anything, he's not going to get rid of these people. He may force them behind the scenes to resign, but he's not going to fire any of them, because that means that he had his judgment was wrong, and he can't admit that that might be the case.
I just wanted to also jump off something that Mark was talking about, and in my previous comment saying we really need to know more what the policy is of the United States toward the Houthis, toward the region in general, and to do that, we need to have serious people who take their jobs seriously, because the details matter. So if the Trump administration is under the impression that the Houthis are purely a proxy of the Iranians, and to hit the Houthis as a way to kind of bring the Iranians to the table is a profound misunderstanding of the many layers of conflict going on in the Arabian Peninsula. And the reasons that the Saudis and the Emiratis were involved had partly to do with Iran, but also to do with other issues. And that's why I think it's so important that we also hold the administration's feet to the fire and saying, what is the policy? You just can't, you know, and this is normally what a Congress would do. They would have oversight hearings. They would call people in. They would make it public, and they would say, you will now tell us, the Department of Defense, what is the strategy? What capacity do we have? What likelihood do we have to be able to meet these goals? And then what? And none of that is happening. So, you know, we're bombing here, we're bombing there, as Mark said, you know, with our great support in weapons and intelligence, the Saudis and Emiratis were bombing for 10 years, and they didn't solve this problem. And the problem is not just about Iran, and it is partially about the transit through the Red Sea and to the Persian Gulf and to Asia. But that really has serious effects on the global economy, but it also has to do with other issues in the Middle East. We're not getting any of that. And so in addition to being, you know, completely irresponsible with the dissemination of classified material, I think they're also profoundly irresponsible with directing our troops. Now, the Biden administration was also engaged, along with Great Britain, in the shooting war with the Houthis. And I'm critical of the Biden administration for also not coming to the American people and saying more clearly, this is why we're doing this. This is why we are putting Americans in harm's way. And this is why we're killing other people toward this goal. The Biden administration also, I think, was far too silent on this. And the American people deserve to know what is going on.
Not a big surprise, Mark. No surprises here. I would just want to tell you that we weren't surprised. But the president said that he has the full support and backing of Secretary Hegseth as of 8:54 this morning. Mm. So that we add that to our knowledge base for whatever that's worth. David writes to us and says, we know it was classified. And how do we know this? Because Waltz was quoted in the Signal chat group commenting that his information was in your high side being top level security. They should all be fired immediately, says David. Then we go to Amy, who says, simple question, how can the military trust Hegseth if he is breaking that trust and putting the military in danger? Why should they answer to him or take any orders from him?
Then let me just say on this question of orders, so the very people who were the most important to make a judgment on what are legal and illegal orders were fired by this administration. Mm-hmm. And I think this was very much on purpose because they don't want those kinds of questions.
Anita writes, any person who works in healthcare knows if they are caught being careless with patient information, they would very quickly lose their jobs. The carelessness and arrogance make my head spin, like so much from the so-called administration does. That from Anita.
And so just to be sure that nobody is surprised in the future, this is kind of like we've all worked in a place where there's a person who's like the total screw up. And you figure as long as they have a job, I'm secure. And so Pete has like set the floor and all the other, secretaries have got to be like, okay, this guy leaked on his personal phone top secret information, classified information. So that's the bar now. So they've all got to be feeling pretty good.
Yeah, because they got away with it.
Yeah.
And I mean, there were no repercussions.
No repercussions. This is it. This is what we're going to get.
Yeah. By the way, I do think, again, going back to the confirmation hearings, he was voted most likely to be the screw-up.
Yes.
I think. With a possible exception of RFK, but...
Oh, God.
Or Cash Patel. I guess there's a pretty long list.
Yeah, there is a
Tulsi Gabbard.
Yeah.
No, I mean, the deal is all these people, right, are playing limbo with that bar in terms of where it is, and that's what... That's what Trump's got around him. And you just have to hope that the political costs mount faster than the actual cost to the United States mm-hmm. and to our interests around the world.
And at what point do the generals step in?
Yeah.
Right.
Because this could have been catastrophic.
While we're on this topic, yes.
Could I just also take a minute? And also because it just doesn't get reported enough. And just say to everyone, what a dire situation the Yemeni people live in. I know we have Yemeni communities here in the capital region. And when I was working in Egypt, my school had a program to work with people who were fleeing the conflict in Yemen. It is one of the worst humanitarian crises on the face of the planet right now, and it gets no play whatsoever. And the poor people who are stuck in the midst of this, I mean, many tens and tens of thousands of people were killed during the war with the Saudis and the Emiratis. The UN estimates that 377,000 people in a small country have died due to food insecurity. 21 million are in dire need of more assistance at the same time that we've ended USAID, we've ended our contracts with many of the NGOs that work around the world on these kinds of things. 5 million people are at risk of famine. There's a cholera outbreak, on and on and on. And so, you know, I also think that the leadership of this country should have to speak to what their plans are to address that issue, as I think the previous administration should have also had a better plan to do that. But at least they did have USAID in place and many NGOs that were receiving U.S. assistance to address these issues.
All right. So let us go to another story. And this is the Supreme Court decision over the weekend. The court's overnight order blocking the Trump administration from deporting a group of Venezuelans under a wartime law. And then the subsequent dissent from Samuel Alito, Justice Alito, who said that the order was not necessary or appropriate because it was before the fact. Justice Samuel Alito dissented in the Supreme Court's decision on Saturday to block the Trump administration from deporting a group of Venezuelan migrants accused of being gang members under a rarely invoked 18th century wartime law, calling the court's order hastily and prematurely granted. This from the from the New York Times. In his five-page dissent released on Saturday shortly before midnight, Justice Alito, joined by Justice Clarence Thomas, wrote that, in his view, the court's decision to intervene overnight was not necessary or appropriate. The court's unsigned one-paragraph order came after a fast-moving legal battle late Friday. The American Civil Liberties Union had rushed to several lower courts, then to the Supreme Court, claiming that the Trump administration was planning to deport more Venezuelan migrants, presumably to El Salvador, with little to no due process under the wartime law, the Alien Enemies Act. The Supreme Court decision ordered a pause on the deportations of the detainees while it considers the emergency applications. Meanwhile, we also will add in here the work of Senator Van Hollen, Senator Chris Van Hollen, who traveled to El Salvador and saying facilitating the return of the wrongly deported man means something more than doing nothing, and they are doing nothing. Van Hollen on Sunday accused the Trump administration of outright defying court orders to return a wrongly deported Maryland man whom Van Hollen met with in El Salvador last week, and he urged the administration to stop releasing unfavorable records about the man. They are flouting the courts as we speak, he said on NBC's Meet the Press. Facilitating his return means something more than doing nothing, and they are doing nothing. Mr. Van Hollen, a Maryland Democrat, traveled to El Salvador last week to press for the release of the man Kilmar Armando Abrega Garcia, who was deported to a notorious Salvadorian prison in March in what an administration lawyer described as an administrative error.
So civil procedure was not my favorite class in law school, but it is this dissent by Alito will be studied. Because the thing that you learn very quickly in civil procedure is that the question is whether the court has jurisdiction. And lawyers are trained to ask that as the first question, right? Does the court have jurisdiction? Does this plaintiff have standing to bring this case? What is the specific procedural posture of a case? Where is it in the system? What can you appeal and what can't you appeal? And I think that it is really telling that the Supreme Court took this action, and it speaks, though, to the fact that prior orders by lower courts were ignored by this administration. And it feels like there's this sense of desperation of, oh, God, before this truly becomes a constitutional crisis, let's stop this from continuing until we can actually hear these cases in a way that will allow us to get to past the procedural pieces of this and get to the substance of this issue as to whether this wartimes clause that they're using can be used for these deportations. So I think this will be, you know, a study. You know, all the procedural lawyers and professors out there, I'm sure, are looking at this and parsing it out. But I think it speaks to where we are at this point in time, that we have this situation of an individual who's sitting in I call it a supermax prison. That's probably too complimentary. And he shouldn't be there. You know, that's got to be horrifying for even U.S. citizens.
I'm concerned. I mean, I'm like, you know, I had to go to Vegas last week. That's why I wasn't here, and not my favorite place in the world. But, you know, I'm like, okay, so is my name on a list? Are they going to let me back into Albany? Are they, you know, I mean, because there are those of us who were very outspoken. And, you know, Trump said to the president of El Salvador, really the dictator of El Salvador, well, we've got some homegrown that we'll send your way and we'll give you some money so you can build more prisons. So, you know, what is the homegrown? The homegrown for him, it's not the grifters, it's not the murderers, it's not the rapists, because he's one of them.
Top secret information.
It's not those either. It's us. It's those of us who dare to voice an opinion counter to what he wants to hear and what he thinks is right. And so I am a little nervous around that. I mean, I don't think it's going to happen tomorrow, but we all have to be cognizant of the fact that this man wants to be a dictator. He is an autocrat. He thinks he runs the show and he doesn't have to answer to anybody, and that Constitution be damned and the Supreme Court be damned.
You know, Ezra Klein, in his most recent article, the headline of it is, "This is the emergency." Mm-hmm. It's not that we might have a constitutional crisis. It's not. We're in the midst of it. There have already been many court orders that have been ignored. And even the Alien Enemies Act hasn't been followed because, number one, it is supposed to be used when we're actually at war with a foreign power. And so their claim that somehow we're at war with Venezuela is lame beyond belief. Secondly, even when it was implemented before, people who were targeted for deportation had an opportunity to contest that and demand that evidence be produced. So we're in a situation where we look back into history, people who were identified as Nazis and supporters of the Third Reich had more rights than the people who were sent to El Salvador in this dragnet. And, you know, there's more and more evidence that it's not just this one person, that there are multiple people who were pulled into this dragnet who don't belong to the gang that Trump says that they all belong to, et cetera. And the reason that we're not sure who's who and who's guilty of what is because we haven't followed the procedure that is set out in the rule of law. So if you just put people on a plane and deport them and then say, oopsie, and, you know, we're not going to do anything about it, that is incredibly dangerous. So back to Ezra Klein, we're in it now. Folks, this is not like something that might happen. We are in the midst of a constitutional crisis.
And the things that are, you know, are being thrown at this. I mean, first of all, Libby, to your point, I mean, he's targeting the people who he spoke about in his Easter greeting, right?
Yeah.
But you know, lovely. Like Matt Gaetz was accused of more serious crimes than this guy was. So just think about that. And what did Trump want him to be?
Gates, Attorney General.
Yeah, Attorney General.
Right.
So think about that. you know, and so I just think, you know, this is the Supreme Court doing something that will be studied for a very long time.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll be back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I was struck this weekend by many articles Friday, Saturday, going into Sunday about the sort of the embrace of Christianity, of the, I think, of evangelicalism within the White House, and the fact that there is a faith office and what is being done. So I just, in that spirit, I would like to read the president's Easter message to us all. Happy Easter to all, including the radical left lunatics who are fighting and scheming so hard to bring murderers, drug lords, dangerous prisoners, and mentally insane, and well-known MS-13 gang members and wife beaters back into our country. Happy Easter also to the weak and ineffective, both those words in capitals, judges and law enforcement officials who are allowing the sinister attack on our nation to continue on, an attack so violent that it will never be forgotten. Sleepy Joe Biden purposefully allowed millions of criminals to enter our country totally unvetted and unchecked through an open borders policy that will go down in history as the single most calamitous act ever perpetrated upon America. He was by far our worst and most incompetent president, a man who has absolutely no idea what he is and was doing. But to him and to the person that ran and manipulated the auto pen, perhaps our real president, and to all of the people who cheated, shouty caps, in the 2020 presidential election in order to get this highly destructive moron elected, I wish you, with great love, sincerity, and affection, a very happy Easter.
That's very Christian of him.
Very presidential, too.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Well, there is that. But on top of this, I mean, you know, are we surprised?
Well, no.
No.
No, don't tell Mark.
We're not surprised.
but Mark, if you are surprised, don't tell Mark.
Yeah. Right, I'm not. But then there's a story that the Trump administration is soliciting ideas to raise the birth rate so that there can be more white babies because all of this, a lot of this, not all of it, but a lot of this comes down to race and the fact that white people won't be the majority in this country in another generation or two. And it scares the living daylights out of them. And they want more white women to have white babies.
Can I just, Joe, I didn't get a chance to comment on the Alito and the Van Hollen story. I want to mark amongst those I do not respect Samuel Alito. This guy lives with his head in a dark place, and you could say the sand. There's probably a less polite place to say. Remember, this is a guy whose wife flew the flag
upside down
and said, I wasn't bribed because the $100 wine really didn't taste good. He also wrote the reliance part of the Dobbs decision, which basically said, yeah, we can reverse these rights and there'll be no real-world consequences. And that, too, really is what he did with this dissent. This dissent is all about procedure. It's clear the majority of the court said, whoa, we're shipping these people off to these supermax, you know, at best facilities. Let's hold the horses here. And Alito's like, ah, you know what? I'm not sure we checked the right comma of the right statute.
Right.
And if you read the dissent, I mean, it's literally just all about procedure, and it's silly. And Van Hollen, I have a lot of time for.
Oh, you can't say that's silly. Oh my! Every law professor who teaches civil procedure just like gasped. But anyway.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Well, somehow the rest of the court, you may not have thought it was silly, but took a different view.
Yeah, yeah.
Van Hollen, I have a lot of time for. You know, the first thing he did was say, "Look," and he said, "None of these allegations against the particular individual have been brought in court. So stop it with the public condemnation of this guy. If you want to bring it in court, bring it." My understanding is less than 5 or 10% of those who we have who've deported on those flights to El Salvador were actually accused of serious crimes, right? But we don't really know because they haven't got due process. Van Hollen also had a, I think, an effective retort to California Governor Newsom, who said, you know, we shouldn't be dealing with this too much because this is a distraction. I do agree. And I think President Trump's tweet over the weekend shows he's trying to distract the American people from the idiocy of some of his other policies, particularly around tariffs. But I think Van Hollen's right that to see one person's rights compromised, even if it's a guest of this country, not necessarily a citizen, is something we all should have an intense interest in. And I'll tell you why. I heard the following, if this doesn't frighten you. So this musing of Trump about how to get Americans into a Venezuelan prison, well, Eric Prince has thought of a way. Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater. Mm-hmm. All we need to do is have a wing of the prison designated U.S. territory, and away we go. So if you don't think that this particular El Salvadorian's rights matter to all of us as people, think again.
Well, due Great process point. Denied to one is due process denied to all. It's just that simple.
Well, I think I think we are on in new territory every day. This Easter greeting being an example of, you know, I mean, I don't know. Do you ever have any clinical psychiatrists on this show? I don't know how you unpack that, right? And like, there are people that like have diagnoses.
I think what the diagnosis is unhinged.
Yeah, it's word vomit. I don't know how else to describe it. But
well, and unfortunate. I mean, it's a very negative look.
Right? Like, what is happening in the psyche of an individual? And I think that it's the otherizing. So this is what's dangerous about it, right? When you go back and you look at what was happening during the rise of the Third Reich, it was the otherizing of people, the demonizing of them, the suggestion to your followers that these people are less than human, that these people are somehow feeble-minded, that they are in need of this great, powerful president because otherwise they are a danger to the rest of us. And that playbook, we know where that goes, but that is what this is about. It's about ensuring that his followers, those who are behind him, see us as less than human, as very, very different from them, and as dangerous.
Yes. I mean, I
didn't mean to shut down the conversation on that happy note.
I mean, I read a piece over the weekend. I don't remember who it was by, but I read a piece over the weekend that basically said just that, in the sense that liberals are the enemy, liberals are the other. And no matter how bad it gets for the Trump supporters, as long as he keeps going after the liberals, they're okay with it.
I mean, if you wanted an Easter pick-me-up, Tom Friedman's piece in the Times this weekend was just devastating. I mean, it's hard to come out of that and not think, oh, God.
We're done.
You know, it's very serious. Okay. I want to, before we wrap up here, and I just want to make sure I have time to mention all this, which is that WAMC is headed to Oneonta. You know, we talked a little while ago about going out on the road, and we have been out on the road, and we're going to continue to go out on the road. And on April 30th, which I believe is a week from this coming Wednesday, we are going to Oneonta. We will, what is April 30th, Libby? Any idea?
No. The last day of April?
100 days of the Trump administration. Oh. Aha. So we, using that very loose framing, we are going to talk to the Hartwick Institute of Public Service, which is run by three incredible individuals, Laurel Elder, a frequent guest on our program, Zachary McKinney, and Matthew Chick. We also will have, I believe, six students, maybe eight, but at least six students who will be on with us talking about various issues, not specifically 100 days, but just about the importance of their work, public service, democracy, sociology, political science, and they will be joining us for this event. You can join us as well. We will be in Shinneman Hall, the Shinneman Chapel House in Hartwick, on Wednesday from 8:30 to 11:30. The show starts at 9. We'll go from 9 to 10:30. And if you would like to find out more information about tickets and how you can join us, it's a fundraiser for WAMC because we needed it. It's you go to WAMC.org. And you can find it from there, from the main page, WAMC.org. But it's WAMC.org/WAMC-on-the-road.
Road. And you can find it there. But just go. It's linked on the homepage, WAMC.org. We would love to have you there. We have very limited tickets, very, very limited tickets. And because the college is sending a lot of people over, and we have our people we want to send over. So please, if you want to go, let us know now. It's a week from Wednesday, and it's in Oneonta. We are very, very excited to be traving to Schoharie County and be out there.
Otsego County.
Otsego County. Thank you very much.
Schoharie is where Cobleskill is.
That's right. All right. I apologize.
That's okay. You know me.
I'm glad you know
all
your...
All the animal shelters and all their counties.
I was See, I thought it was libraries, but
Now it's all the animal shelters and their counties. All right.
So we are very excited. Welcome, and please find out more at WAMC.org. Okay. We have a few minutes left. Irene says, thanks for reading Trump's Easter wishes for the world to know. I hadn't read that. He is a dark and disturbed person. Then we go to Bob. Let's take a moment to enjoy how furious the MAGA world is about Amy Coney Barrett's lack of deference to the Trump administration. She has the potential to become a real force for good. Then we go to Steve. If Trump really did suggest that homegrown criminals could be deported to El Salvador, it follows that he could be the first one on the plane.
Yeah, well.
He really did suggest it.
Yeah, he really did suggest it. It's on tape, actually, yes. In his discussion.
That's what happens when there's a hot mic.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not like he was trying to hide it. I mean, it was, yeah, part of the shtick. All right. So, and then finally, I guess the last thing to that we don't really have a whole lot of time for, but I do think is the enormity of this Harvard story, which continues, and it we'll talk more about it tomorrow, but it's we sent them the note, then we sent it by accident, and then we told them we sent it by accident, and then we doubled down, and then they blamed Harvard for taking them seriously because they got a note that was on letterhead and signed by three officials that they had been dealing with.
Oops.
And then now they're talking about doing an additional holding back of $1 billion. So I think this obviously is a story that will continue to play out. Jim?
And also threatening to revoke the tax-exempt status of Harvard and also other universities who don't fall in line with what the administration wants on a wide variety of issues. So, you know, in addition to the attack on the institutions of higher education, at the same time we also see an attack on the students of these institutions and the revocation of the visas for international students. I am seeing and I'm hearing from so many people around the world that either have their kids in universities in the States or are thinking of sending them there. And in many of these cases, they are either thinking of not sending them here or taking them back and sending them somewhere else. And so the loss to American higher education and to the United States in general is going to be massive. If we take international students out of the mix of who goes to our institutions of higher education, they will be very different institutions, and the communities around these institutions will suffer immensely from a lack of resources, both intellectual and financial.
And the research building on that is happening at these institutions literally saves lives.
Yeah.
And so when you look at the upending, you can't just stop funding research and expect it to be able to continue at the level and with the people. These are folks who are funded through this money.
Right.
Their equipment is funded through this money. And so looking at the real lives that are impacted by this, it's really incredibly frightening to think about the loss of real advancement in these areas that are so critically important to our health moving forward, to understanding impacts of our environment. But of course, it seems like facts and science are things that this administration is trying to shy away from. So they might think that that's just fine.
We'll hold it there on this Monday morning. My thanks to our terrific group, Jim Ketterer, Libby Post, Mayor Sheehan, and Mark Whitman. My thanks to you all for being with us this morning. We will continue with more program after this.